Good morning. It's time for In the Green Outdoors with Gail Martin and Carol Kelly. Each week, the ladies will bring you gardening and planting ideas, tell you about native Ohio plants, prairies and habitats, and great tips for everything in the green outdoors. This week with Carol Kelly.
Hello again, everyone. Well, today I want to share some thoughts and information about various insects, the bad as well as some good ones. And yes, as I have pointed out before, there are lots of good ones. Let me start with one of these garden helpers. Over the past week or so, I've been noticing small, brightly colored flies with unusually long legs on the foliage of some of my garden plants. I have found out that these are long-legged flies. They are noticeable, despite their very tiny size, due to their metallic colors, which may be shades of green, blue, bronze, gold, or a variety of other hues. Long-legged flies are beneficial predators, both as adults and larvae. They feed on a variety of small, soft-bodied arthropods, including other flies, thrips, aphids, spider mites, springtails, leaf hoppers, white flies, small caterpillars, even termites. The larvae of some long-legged flies eat other small arthropods in soil, while still others are believed to be scavengers. Now, these tiny flies pose no threat at all to humans. They don't bite, sting, or spread diseases. Plus, they prefer to remain outdoors, so it's unlikely you'll find long-legged flies in your home. The adults can be found in a wide variety of habitats, such as gardens, meadows, and landscapes near water margins. In these habitats, adults commonly can be found perched on partially shaded vegetation, searching for prey. Once prey is captured, they use their mouthparts to hold, pierce, and extract internal fluids. Sounds appetizing. Long-legged fly larvae are commonly found near semi-aquatic landscapes or under tree bark or mulch. I began looking into these insects since I've been seeing them mostly on the leaves of my cucumbers and summer squash as I've been tending these and the other vegetable plants in my raised beds. I had the feeling while watching them that they are predators, and I am happy to have found that my assumption was correct. I was hoping to find that they are predators of the adult cucumber beetles, but they are not. I have read that those pests would have spent the winter as adults in weedy areas and move into planted fields and gardens as soon as plants start to come up. However, I've only begun seeing these cucumber beetles in the last week or so. These I see now are not going to be the only generation, however. There are several generations a year. The adults I am seeing will lay their eggs at the base of plants or in cracks in the soil. The larvae that emerge then burrow into the ground seeking out roots, feed for two to six weeks, pupate, and then emerge as adult beetles once more to renew the attack on the above ground portions of the plants. Since, as I said, the arrival of the beetles was recent, in my garden anyway, my plants now are tall and vigorous, so hopefully I will harvest a number of cucumbers before the bacterial wilt spread by the insects brings the vines to an end. I've been getting plenty of summer squash for several weeks now, yellow squash as well as zucchini, and those plants should continue producing for some time. I expect to be weary of those fruits before they succumb to the beetles, squash bugs, or squash vine borers. But what I've been doing in hopes of prolonging the harvest is to dust the leaves of all the cucurbits with DE, diatomaceous earth, while avoiding the flowers themselves, since I don't want to harm the bees as they work the plants, nor do I want to deter the various general predators that may be on patrol, insects such as green lace wings, assassin bugs, minute pirate bugs, soldier beetles, ground beetles, and various spiders, all of whom I welcome to my yard. DE is not a poison, but works as an insecticide by mechanically damaging the exoskeleton of various pest insects. Although it feels like talcum powder to us, the sharp edges of the DE particles pierce the protective outer layer of the pests, causing them to lose essential body fluids. As a result, the insects ultimately dehydrate and die. So, in hopes of thwarting the squash vine borer, a brightly colored moth that really looks more like some sort of a fat orange and black bee or wasp, I've also been dusting the base of all my squash plants, since it's there that the borer lays her eggs. Once the larvae hatch, they bore into the thick plant stem, leaving behind a trail of chewed plant sawdust as well as frass. Remember that word? It's the correct term for caterpillar excrement. Unless the larva is found excavating the stem and removed, the plant comes to an early demise. Another pest that generally is present in the hundreds, if not thousands, in many yards is the Japanese beetle. Now, while I've seen a few this summer, there are not nearly as many as I have had in previous years. What about cicadas? Are you hearing their rasping song where you are? I noted when I heard the first cicada calling this year in my yard. It was on June 29. Since then, I have heard the occasional one, but the number of these were down since last year, and I suspect it may be the same thing again. As scientists have been warning us for years, insect numbers are noticeably declining. And also this year, just as last year, people I talk to report seeing very few butterflies of any kind, despite more people being aware of the value of most insects and the numbers of people making it a point to plant native flowers for the pollinators. I mentioned in my opening remarks today that there are many helpful insects. The healthier the soil and the greater the biodiversity in an ecosystem, or putting it in everyday terms, the greater the variety of native plants, birds, and yes, even insects that you can attract to your yard, the more nature will be in balance and the so-called bad bugs will not get the upper hand. I've mentioned before that more than 97% of insect species are either directly beneficial to gardens or have no impact at all on human activity, leaving less than 3% that are agricultural or nuisance pests. Yes, I know. 3% of 1.5 million insect species is still a very discouraging number. But by encouraging a natural balance in your yard, the good or benign bug species outnumber the bad ones by a huge margin. I have found this to be true in my yard. Actually, the worst pests that I have are squirrels and chipmunks and the occasional deer. And remember, in addition to insects that eat other insects, we have many more allies: birds, bats, toads, frogs, snakes, mammals like skunks, raccoons, foxes. Even your pet dog or cat won't pass up eating insects, sometimes even those yucky slugs that like to shred your hosta leaves. When my segment of the In the Green Outdoors early last month, I spoke a bit about fireflies. Recently in my backyard, I saw an insect that I've been seeing off and on now and then for a number of years, but never had made any attempt to identify it until a couple of weeks ago, when I finally became curious enough to do some research. The beetle looks nearly identical to a firefly, but it does not have the telltale lantern-like segment on its abdomen as does a firefly. I see these insects from time to time on or under a leaf by day, just sitting there. I found that this is a relative in the Lampyridae family, but one that does not produce light. Unlike their flashing cousins, these non-luminescent lampyrids are active during the day. Hence, they are called diurnal fireflies. Diurnal, of course, meaning daytime. A more descriptive name would be diurnal flameless fireflies. Another difference between the two species is that these lanternless beetles overwinter as adults, while the flashing kind spend the winter in the larval stage. Thus, diurnal flameless fireflies sometimes are called winter fireflies, owing to the ability of the adults to survive low winter temperatures. These insects have distinct firefly markings on their prothoracic shield, which is the flat structure covering the head. However, they have no lanterns on the undersides. The adults feed on pollen and nectar, as do the other fireflies. At one time, it was speculated that these flameless fireflies are simply primitive lampyrids. They represent the way fireflies once looked and behaved before they evolved into the fireflies we know today. However, research on the phylogenetic relationships of the fireflies has revealed that the story behind flameless fireflies is far more complicated, but I'm going to pass over those scientific details and leave it to the listeners who wish to know more to do your own research. But wait, listeners may recall that I pointed out in my earlier segment that the flashing signals of the males in flight are how they find mates. So how do the diurnal flameless fireflies find their mates? Well, the answer is that they have pheromones in the waxy film on their backs that is carried on the breeze as a come-hither signal to a potential mate. What is especially interesting is that the larvae of these flameless fireflies are bioluminescent, and so also are referred to as glowworms. The larvae, like their cousins, are carnivorous and include in their diet slugs, snails, and the larvae of other insects. Before I sign off, recent weather conditions inspire me to mention that Saturday, July 15th, is St. Swithin's Day, celebrated in Britain. The St. Swithin's Day legend is an old one. The earliest surviving written reference dates way back to the 14th century, although its roots are much disputed. St. Swithin was an Anglo-Saxon bishop of Winchester who died around 862 AD. The clergyman had requested that his remains be interred among the common people outside the church, but in 971, after he had been made patron saint of Winchester Cathedral, his body was dug up and moved to a new indoor shrine. It has been written that this caused sufficient displeasure in the heavens for a terrible downpour to strike the church and continue unabated for 40 days. Hence the following legend. St. Swithin's Day, if thou dost reign, for 40 days it will remain. St. Swithin's Day, if thou be fair, for 40 days 'twill rain na mare. Well, a look ahead at the 10-day forecast indicates a high of 90 degrees and anticipates afternoon thunderstorms on that day. Until next time, this is Carol Kelly saying, you just might want to look up plans for constructing an ark in the green outdoors.
And there's your show for the week. In the Green Outdoors is a production of WZMO Radio. The show airs Saturdays and Mondays right after the second cup at about 9:30 a.m. If you have a question or comment for Carol or Gail, you can email it to WZMO@roadrunner.com. Thank you for listening.